Hello and welcome to the Chester named London Theatre Podcast. My name is TRP Watson and this time I'm joined by Phil from the West End Whingers and Gareth James. We're now going to talk about a very, very, very dark matter at the Bridge Theatre. This is a world premiere of a play by Martin McDonagh, directed here by Matthew Dunster, with a design by Anna Fleischel. It stars Janetta Ulamae Ackles as Marjorie, a one-legged pygmy who lives in a glass box in the attic of the house of Hans Christian Andersen, who's played by Jim Broadbent. And it seems that she writes all his stories for him. He just changes them to make them sound a little bit more Danish rather than African. And the same seems to apply to a certain Charles Dickens, who also features in this. He's played by Phil Daniels, with his wife Catherine played by Elizabeth Berrington. Among other members of the cast, we have Graham Hawley and Ryan Pope, who play a couple of Belgian soldiers. And then we also have Lee Knight and Paul Bradley in other minor roles. Lee Knight plays Edvard, who is Hans Christian Andersen's editor and publisher. And Paul Bradley is a member of the press who is trying to find out the truth about Hans Christian Andersen and may pay for that truth. The story, I mean, is essentially that this sort of revelation that these great 19th century writers had their writing ghostwritten for them by captured pygmy women from the Belgian Congo. But it does get a little bit confusing because these captured pygmy women from the Belgian Congo seem to be from later in the 19th century, and there's some kind of time travel going on. And the Belgian officials or soldiers that we meet seem like ghosts, but they're not ghosts from the past, they're ghosts from the future. They are people who seem to have been re-stitched together after being cut up. I did wonder if these two Belgians were called Dupond and Dupont, or maybe people might be more familiar with the idea of Thompson and Thompson. Whenever you see a pair of Belgians who look alike or dress alike, then you do tend to think they might be a creation of Hergé. As well as the central idea of these writers essentially being ghostwritten for, you also have this thing which isn't properly, I didn't think was properly explained, of time travel between the late 19th century when Leopold II's slave empire in the Belgian Congo, and I don't use those words without being able to justify them, when his slave empire really got into gear and people were discovering how terrible it was. You had people like Joseph Conrad writes Heart of Darkness, which features the Belgian Congo and how bad it was. But you also get a man called Sir Roger Casement, who basically opened the eyes of the rest of Europe to what the king of the Belgians were doing. Belgium covers this up. If you think that Britain covers up what it thinks about its empire, it has nothing on Belgium. Belgium simply do not talk about this. They don't admit it. And the slaughter in the Belgian Congo was appalling. So we get elements of that within the play, but unfortunately, it doesn't match with the rest of the play, because the rest of the play is this. It's not just because it's a rather fun idea. You have this wonderful, I think, portrayal of Hans Christian Andersen by Jim Broadbent. He's a complete idiot and he's very reliant on his ghostwriter for creating all his ideas. And then when you get the scenes, which is real life, he went to go and stay with Charles Dickens and he overstayed his welcome for quite a long time. You also get this wonderful portrayal of Charles Dickens. I mean, he's Phil Daniels, he's very London, he's very, almost a Cockney, you might say, but you are reminded that Charles Dickens, he was a son of a debtor. He started life in a bootblack factory, pasting labels on bootblacking. This guy is almost not educated and suddenly to become a great writer and a giant of writing in the 19th century. It's a really nice portrayal. And we also get good support from people like Elizabeth Berrington and Paul Bradley. But the problem with this play, in some ways, is that it was too short for me. It's an hour and a half straight through. Yes, okay, everyone's going to laugh at that one.
I have to interject there, yes.
But no, it's too short in that it doesn't develop its themes properly. It doesn't, you've got some really great ideas in here. And as I say, I think that the idea of the pygmy women in the box is great. The portrayals of Hans Christian Andersen and Charles Dickens are great. And yeah, okay, we can go off into the idea of the terrible things that happened in the Belgian Congo. That's certainly interesting, but it doesn't hang together well, and you need to develop things more. I mean, the relationship between, say, Charles Dickens and Catherine Dickens is fascinating. You know, Charles Dickens broke up with his wife in a rather spectacular fashion. He built a wall in their house so he wouldn't ever have to see her again. And this is a massively broken relationship. We only get a tiny hint of that, and there's lots of elements where you could expand them into something which would be really great. And it's, for me, it was too cut down. I mean, okay, given that the play itself wears you out at an hour and a half, you might think, well, God, if it was 2 hours, it'd be even worse. But at 2 hours, you'd also be able to build your world properly, because the whole idea that these trapped pygmy women are somehow time-travelling from the late 19th century is not well explored, it's not well explained. I mean, when you do some fantasy elements like that, you need to understand the way that your magic works, the mechanics of it a little bit, in order to make it work. And he doesn't care. He just says, no, it's like this, and I'm not going to explain it. And it feels frustrating. So I could see some great elements in this play, but I think that it didn't really hang together very well. There's some good bits and there's some wonderful performances, but it really was disappointing in the end, because it doesn't hang together, because you get one or two tasty morsels, but you don't get a feast. And you always want a feast with Martin McDonagh. When you're looking at this, you see Jim Broadbent in a Martin McDonagh play, and you remember the Pillow Man, and the Pillow Man was magnificent, and you're really hoping that he is going to give you something like the Pillow Man, and you simply don't get it. What do you think about this film?
Well, I'd like to have built a wall between myself and the play. I really did not like this. I would say not at all. At first, I was sort of creeped out in a good way by when you enter the auditorium, Marjorie's box is sort of swinging on the stage. It's very, very, very dark, appropriately enough, given the punctuationless title. And I thought, oh, this is going to be very, very creepy and strange. It's certainly strange. I'm not really sure what Hans Christian Andersen and or Dickens come to that did to deserve being presented in this way. For a start, neither of them are Belgium. If it's about colonial guilt and atrocities, unless Europe is taking the blame collectively, which perhaps there's a strong argument for Brexit behind the play. Who knows? You could almost read anything into it, because I just thought this was really a huge disappointment. Like you, I was a massive fan of Pillar Man. That sort of stands up as one of the best, most enjoyable sort of theatre experiences, particularly regarding a play, that I've ever seen. It was weird and it was wonderful and it had all sorts of things going on. This, to me, didn't really. And I found my irritation factor kicked in quite early on. Typical of Martin McDonagh, he kind of has lots of sort of bad language and shocks and things like that, which is fine. And if they're funny and amusing and entertaining, then I'm on board with them. But in this, I felt he was really struggling to make people shocked. The swearing, the use of the C word and the F word just became tiresome. And when Hans Christian Andersen goes to visit Dickens and stays in London, we're presented with a very sweary Dickens, a very sweary wife, and even worse, very sweary children, which is obviously done for comedy value. But the trouble is, it wasn't funny. There were a few moments where this promised to be the best scene in it, and it kind of did make me laugh a few times. But then it outstayed its welcome with a string of, I don't know if maybe they'd cut them since I saw it, because I did see it in sort of a relatively early preview, Dickens book title gags, which just got lamer and lamer as they went on. A bit like Marjorie, really. I think 90 minutes actually was too much for me anymore. And I think, well, I mean, if there'd been a play with an interval, I think a lot of people left. Some people left behind me about 10 to 15 minutes in, possibly put off by the swearing. Probably with me, I would have stuck it out, because it's Martin McDonagh and he's, you know, I think almost everything he's done apart from this, I've found it thoroughly engaging, entertaining, very, very funny. But this was just such a misfire on so many levels. I didn't think actually any of you say the wonderful performances. I didn't see any wonderful performances in it. I thought Jim Broadbent was doing another version of Jim Broadbent. The presentation of Hans Christian Andersen as sort of a probable gay, he never married in real life, so that's possibly true, hinting at possibly that he's a paedophile, but making him a sort of sadistic kidnapper is kind of, I mean, you could only do that with somebody who's been long dead, because the estate would be complaining about it. I really don't think, if people who've read the bad reviews, there have been a couple of good ones, people aren't going to book to see this. This is going to be, for me, another misfire in the Bridge. I haven't seen everything that's been at the Bridge, but I haven't seen anything that I would say was good yet, and this is the one that I expected to be fantastically entertaining. I will give a word for Anna Bleschel's set. I'm not sure how you pronounce her name. I thought the attic set was wonderfully atmospheric, rather good lighting, albeit rather crepuscular. But that's me really trying to find good things to say about it. It was a complete dud.
So, Gareth, what did you think about A Very, Very Dark Matter?
I think what we need to say first about this play, really, is that if this was an unknown playwright or a relatively new playwright who submitted this play to any major theatre or subsidised theatre, the most generous thing they would have done is offered him some advice on how to rewrite it and perhaps restructure it. The less generous amongst them would have just thrown it back. I think the only reason we're seeing this play is because it is the eighth or ninth Martin McDonagh play. All the others have been in high-profile stagings. Who's going to turn down a Martin McDonagh play, particularly as he's moved on from that to Oscar-winning films, and indeed is getting his earlier plays revived in the West End very successfully? So it shouldn't be on. I think that's the first thing I'd say. What he seems to be doing, as both of you have kind of pointed out, he seems to have got as his targets colonialism, and particularly the Belgians. And also, I think he wants to knock these two writers off their pedestals for whatever reason. But the way he's gone about that is very confusing, because the sequence and timing of things is just all over the place. You know, so you've got these writers in the late 19th, I think early 20th century, and then you've got things happening much later than that. I think there's an implausibility that both these writers have got their sort of pygmies doing their writing for them. I just thought that was just bonkers, really. And then you put foul words into the mouths of 8 to 12 year olds, which is, again, completely implausible. It just wouldn't be happening just because you want to shock your audience. So, you know, I just thought he obviously had some targets in mind for whatever reason, but it didn't work at all for me. You know, it's quite sinister, and it's got quite a nice sinister tone about it. And I liked the design, as you both commented on. I actually thought that, I'm going to have to get a name right here, Jonetta Ulemae-Eccles as Marjorie in his professional debut was extremely impressive. I, like Phil, thought that Jim Broadbent was really not in. I mean, it seemed to me he wasn't really into the role. And, you know, there were other good performances, but I just thought it fell flat on its face, I'm afraid. It's a half-baked attempt to shock people in a way that for me was kind of pointless. And when you put this play against the other plays I've seen of his, the Six Set in Ireland, plus The Hangman, this is just nowhere near as good. It's just miles away from them, which is a great shame. And it's only this year, you know, we've been seeing a cracking revival of The Lieutenant of Inishmore, packing them out in the West End. So what a great shame.
One of the things I didn't bring up, I wonder if this is a problem that Nicholas Heitner has had, because we know historically from when he was at the National Theatre as an artistic director, wasn't really standing up to people like Alan Bennett, and we also saw Tony Harrison with Fram, where they needed work, they needed attention from a dramaturg or an artistic director who was prepared to go in and muck around. I mean, Nicholas Heitner's written about his experiences at the National Theatre and talks about going in and getting his hands dirty with things like War Horse and his Dark Materials, and really working on getting those plays right, and then he just gives a bye to other playwrights. So we've had slightly disappointing play from Richard Bean at the Bridge Theatre, and then I think the Alan Bennett was the best Alan Bennett we've seen for a while with Alleluia, and then we get this, which, yeah, obviously he's simply not written back and saying this doesn't work, go back and rethink it. So I just wonder if this is a problem of Nicholas Heitner's creation, and I probably wonder what can be done about it.
Well, I'm not sure I'd subscribe to that theory. I think that we've had three other okay plays at the Bridge. You know, we had the Barney Norris, which he obviously did on the strength of Barney Norris's growing reputation. We had the Richard Bean, which I thought was good. Wasn't great, but it was good enough. And I thought the Alan Bennett was better than the last one and wasn't that bad, really. So I think this stands out as the dud in the Bridge's short period. And I think there were only one or two where he didn't rein them in the National for me, and people was one of them, the Alan Bennett play. I didn't actually see Fram, so I couldn't comment on that. But there were probably others. I suspect David Hare comes to mind, but I can't think of which play that might be. But I'm not sure I'd subscribe to the theory that he personally has a problem with that. I mean, he didn't direct this, so his role in reining in the play is really Matthew Dunster, who should have been doing that. He's the director of the play, but he did presumably either commission or agree to put it on, and we hope read it. But it wouldn't surprise me to find that he hadn't read it, that Martin McDonagh said, "Do you want to play?" And he said, "Oh, yes, please." And I think if I'd been in the same boat, I might have been as tempted as he would have been, because, you know, this guy has been a banker up to now. So I'm not sure I'm entirely of the view that it's Nick Hitner, but it's certainly a bad call on this occasion.
We're now going to talk about Measure for Measure at the Donmar Warehouse. This is an adaptation of the Shakespeare play, directed here by Josie Rourke, with designed by Peter McIntosh. The two stars of this play are Hayley Atwell, who plays Isabella, and Jack Loudon, who plays Angelo. And what they have done with this is they have given us rather a lot in rather a long night, basically two versions of the play. They've taken a cut down version of Measure for Measure and they play it through fairly straight. It's Elizabethan played and really centres on the relationship between Angelo and Isabella, with Nicholas Burns as the Duke coming in as well. And in the second half we get the play again, but this time we're in modern dress and Isabella takes on the part that Angelo normally plays, and vice versa. Although Angelo, of course, in the second half is not a nun, but he belongs to a religious community. They're joined in this play by Ben Allen, Matt Bardock, Jackie Clune, Rachel Denning, Molly Harris, Adam McNamara, Rad Rory, Sule Rimi, Anwar Russell, and Helena Wilson. Gareth, tell me more about this play and what you thought of it.
Well, I think I disagree with you. First of all, it's a long evening because it's about 2 hours 40, 2 hours 45 to see Measure for Measure twice, when Measure for Measure once is normally that length, if not slightly longer than that. So I wouldn't call it a long evening. As you say, you get the play twice. The first time is a 75-minute fairly conventional version, a period costume, and a good staging of the play. And before the interval, which I think is quite clever, they then start the play a second time. There's a sort of coup de théâtre, and then they start the play a second time, but, you know, jumping forward 400 years, I guess, to the present day, and then doing the play again in modern costume. And the difference is that the Duke, who has trusted Angelo with Vienna is basically has degenerated into a very debauched city. And when the Duke decides to leave, he puts Angelo in charge of the city. But of course, this is Shakespeare, so he's hovering in the background in disguise, monitoring activities as a friar, as it happens. And Angelo, therefore, looks after the city. He takes quite a sort of no mercy approach to things and condemns Claudio to death just for having sex with his girlfriend outside marriage. And Isabella is Claudio's sister, who's about to go into a nunnery, but then delays her entrance to plead for her brother. And that's when we see Angelo misusing his power in a way that's become fairly commonplace today. So what they've done effectively is that in the second version, apart from the fact it's modern, instead of the Duke trusting Angelo with the city, the Duke trusts Isabella with the city. So Isabella is looking after the city. So what we're seeing is how the change of gender affects how the play plays out and how you see it and how others see the characters and so on. So Angelo effectively becomes Claudio's brother, who has to plead for his brother's life, where Isabella had pleaded for her brother's life. So that's the only real change in the whole thing. And the second one is shorter, so sort of 10-minute shorter. And of course, because it's contemporary, we get the usual mobile phones and other contemporary preferences. But all we've really got is two protagonists who've changed gender. And I think it's actually very clever and it's very timely. And I was quite fascinated by the evening, really. But at the end of the evening, I sort of thought, it's making some really interesting points here, but it's an awful lot of trouble to go to do it. We do treat the same situation differently depending on the sex of the protagonist, and that kind of, you know, is an important point that's proven here. But it wasn't as emphasized as I was expecting, and I just kind of wondered, Was it worth such a radical reinvention to make that point? Were there other ways you could have made that point? I thought it was a great idea. I thought it was well executed. I thought it was very well performed. I thought that in addition to Hayley Atwell and Jack Loudon, who are both excellent, there were some great performances from Sule Rimi as Claudio and Nicholas Burns as a very affable Duke. And Matt Bardock as Lucio, which is, every time I see Image for Measure, I always think how important Lucio's part is. And here we've also got Adam McNamara coming into his own, I thought, as the Provost, and Ryad Rowie as Aeschylus. So, I think an interesting idea, well executed, well performed, made you think. But I just wondered at the end of the day, was it a lot of trouble to go to? What did you think, Tim?
I was a little bit nervous when I read about this because I was very nervous that I wouldn't get to see Hayley Atwell do the Angelo part. I mean, the Angelo part, she's always Isabella, but, in the second half, she is playing the Angelo part, and I really wanted to see that. And I wasn't disappointed by that at all because I thought she was extremely good in both roles. And she had a bit of a wobble in an earlier production this year, and the play didn't show her in the best light. But this really does, and it shows how good she can be and how good she is. As you said, it's a very effective cut of Measure for Measure, and everybody, I think, pretty much shines. I'm not sure that Nicholas Burns's Duke is quite sympathetic in the, it's certainly not in the second one, and there is that whole thing of when he sort of proposes at the end, spoiler for Measure, he proposes to Isabel at the end of the play, and it's always a difference how they get the actors to treat that. Either Isabel kind of accepts the proposal or she outright refuses doing it, and he's a lot more creepy. It feels a lot more creepy when he's talking to Angelo in the second half. I did have a problem, and I think one or two other people have, is the way you translate Angelo into the 21st century, into the contemporary time, is that I couldn't see why he was, I could not understand why he was celibate and why he wanted to keep his celibacy, why it was so important to him. And they've not made it that he's sort of a Catholic priest or anything like that, which might have worked. So you immediately understood why he would might want to be celibate. Instead, we have this strange New Age culty Christian community, and too much information that you would have to get about this community, which I didn't think quite worked, because it didn't explain it, and it simply, you just simply said, why is this man celibate? What is it about him? And the cost for a woman in 1603 or 1604, when this was first done, of a woman having sex out of wedlock are potentially enormous. Because if you have a child, then you're an outcast, and to a certain extent your life is ruined. And if you are known to have had sex, your life could be ruined. And it's not quite the same here, and it's certainly not ever the same. Didn't really feel the same for men. And I just that sort of odd note that just didn't work with me. But overall, this is very well performed. Yeah, like you say, Matt Bardock, I've seen him for years and he's really always really good. It's a good reimagining, apart from the whole question of Angelo in the second half for me. But it really worked. It was a very nice cut. You didn't feel that you were missing out an awful lot of the play, although you must have been missing an hour in each case of the play, but it didn't feel too much like that. They got all the notes in there and all the sort of important pieces of Measure for Measure in the play, and it worked really quite well. So it's only the Angelo in the second half that really bothered me. We're now going to talk about Wise Children at the Old Vic. This is an adaptation of Angela Carter's novel by Emma Rice, and is also directed here by Emma Rice. This is essentially the launch of Emma Rice's new company, which is also called Wise Children, which is sort of set up after leaving Shakespeare's Globe and is a successor company to her previous company, Knee High. The set and costume design here is by Vicky Mortimer. We have a cast that includes Sam Archer, Ankur Bahl, Stu Barker, Amari Douglas, Mirabelle Grimaud, Alex Hearn, Paul Hunter, Melissa James, Beatrice Jones, Patricia Kujawaska, Etta Murfitt, Katie Owen, Ian Ross, Mike Shepherd, of course, and Gareth Snook. This is the second adaptation that Emma Rice has done of Angela Carter's novels. She previously did Knights of the Circus, and it certainly felt when I was watching this, we are going back to what Knee High have always done and what's good about Knee High. The play is about the story of two 75-year-old ex-dancing girls. They're twins, and they are celebrating their birthday and are invited to their father's birthday. Their father is a famous actor who has a little of Laurence Olivier about him, perhaps, but even more conceited and even more unpleasant. And their father is celebrating his 100th birthday. They tell essentially the story of their lives, the story of their father's life and how they came into the world. They are unacknowledged by him. They are a by-blow, if you like. They are the result of a relationship he had with a chambermaid at an actor's boarding house, and they are brought up by the owner of that actor's boarding house, who they refer to as Grandma. And these two sisters learn to dance. One of the things in this play is that there are an awful lot of twins. So the sisters are Dora and Nora Chance, and their father is Sir Melchior Hazard. We have a lot of words like chance and hazard and luck and stuff like that in this play. Melchior has a younger twin brother who is called Peregrine. And Peregrine and Melchior are very, very different. Melchior is the classical actor. His father was a classical actor. His mother also became a classical actor, did Hamlet, and got involved with one of the members of the Booth family of America, which included great actors and also assassins. They end tragically, leaving behind these two twins. The twins go their separate ways. Melchior goes on to become an important actor, and Peregrine becomes, well, lots of different things. He becomes a miner, he becomes a naturalist, he becomes an entrepreneur, and he is the one who first acknowledges the daughters when he meets them, having been asked to pay them off by his brother, and sees their talent and gets some dancing lessons, and they become relatively successful hoofers on the variety circuit. There's a lot of this idea of Melchior Hazard being the legitimate stage and the girls, these two twins we're following, being the illegitimate, the variety, the more commonplace music hall from the musicals. Their lives keep intersecting, especially as when the girls become a little bit more successful, they get involved in a film, and you see this relationship between the father, the uncle, and these two twins, these dancing girls, basically from before they're born to right up to when they're 75. They use different actors to portray the sisters at different ages. We have Gareth Snook, who is Dora, who is the narrator, plays older Dora, along with Etta Murphy playing the older Nora. And then we also get Melissa James playing Dora as the showgirl, and Omari Douglas playing Nora when they're showgirls. And then we also get Beatrice Jones and Mirabel Grimaud playing young Dora and young Nora. And there are people playing lots of different parts. They develop a relationship both with Melchior's later wife, who actually quite likes them, and their twin daughters, again, the twins come back in, who are beastly to our heroines. So we're telling a sort of a complex tale, really about theatrical history. If you know the sort of periods they're talking about, you can guess at people. I mean, like I said, Melchior Hazard is a bit too old to be Laurence Olivier, but you can think of an actor manager a bit like that. Perhaps Melchior Hazard is a Donald Wolfe type character, or slightly older than that. But you see lots of echoes if you know a little bit about that period and that time. Lots of echoes. They miss some things out in the book. There are more twins, and also there's an extended sequence. They mention going to America to make a film of Midsummer Night's Dream. And that's much more detailed in the book. And in fact, it resembles the famous Hollywood version of A Midsummer Night's Dream rather closely. On the whole, I found this a pretty accurate version of the book. I mean, obviously, there are cutdowns. For me, it worked really quite well. I mean, I did read the book after I saw the play. I was pretty happy with the play as it was done. It is very familiar if you know your Emma Rice. It's a familiar way of doing things. But, you know, that's not necessarily a bad thing. There's slightly acid overtones when it talks about Shakespeare. There's an awful lot of Shakespeare in here, so everybody remembers the problems that Emma Rice had at the Globe. I thought this works really well. It is very familiar if you know your knee-high. It's very typical knee-high, but I did think it worked extremely well and was very, very charming. There is a slightly disturbing part, which is also in the novel. It's something which one or two people have pulled out and been rather distressed by, and it has upset one or two reviewers, I think. What did you think about this, Gareth?
I think the problem with someone like Emma Rice, who, incidentally, I am a huge fan of as a theatre maker. I wasn't a fan of her as the director of Shakespeare's Globe, but I am a big fan of her as a theatre maker, and I've seen about 18 of her productions. But the problem is she has a very, very distinctive house style, and all of her plays have these ingredients, the same ingredients. There'll almost always be puppetry in there. There'll certainly be music. There's some dance. There'll be men playing women and women playing men. And it will be very inventively staged, unquestionably. And it'll have a kind of childlike playfulness about it. And I think the problem with that here is the subject matter is much more adult than she's tackled before, I think. I mean, she's done dark tales, but I think, you know, here we've got ambiguous parenthood, incest, child abuse, suspected murder. So, you know, we've got a lot of adult themes in here, and yet the style is quite childlike. So that kind of jarred a little bit for me. And the second reason is because it was number 18, I think, I felt I was seeing a lot of recycled ideas. I was seeing a lot of things that I've seen before. And I appreciate that, you know, other people in the audience might not have seen any or just a small number, wouldn't therefore feel the same about it. But for me, that gave it a bit of a staleness because I felt I was seeing a lot of things done again. And thirdly, I didn't really engage with the story. I mean, I should because it's a sort of theatrical dynasty, so it's right up my street, really. But for some reason, I didn't really engage with the story of these people. They were just a bunch of eccentric, sometimes dark, sometimes funny, and I didn't find myself getting involved in it. And the three most recent Emma Rice pieces we've had, Romantics Anonymous, The Flying Lovers of Potemsk, and her revival of Brief Encounter, what all three of those have got that this doesn't have is an extraordinary empathy with the characters and bucket loads of charm. And I think the problem here is that the characters aren't. You can't empathize with the characters in the same way as you can with all of those plays. So there's a kind of cocktail of things going on for me here that's about her style vis-a-vis the subject matter of the play and the recycling of the style. And I think it's really ironic that she's chosen to do this as the first production since leaving Shakespeare's Globe, because it is based on and inspired by this novel by Angela Carter, which itself is inspired by her admiration for Shakespeare. So I found that was deeply ironic, as you sort of touched on, really. There's loads of talent on show, obviously, lots of knee-high regulars. I mean, what she's got here is knee-high too, to be frank, because if you didn't see Wise Children as the producer, you'd think it was knee-high. And she's got a lot of the regulars who are really, really good. Vicky Mortimer's design, I thought, was excellent. This is the biggest stage I think I've seen an Emma Rice production on, and I kind of did worry, is it too big a stage? Because the old Vicky is very big. But actually, with Vicky Mortimer's design, I actually didn't think the theatre was too big at all. So that wasn't an issue for me. The choreography was very good. And Etta Murfitt, who does the choreography, who's one of Matthew Bourne's proteges, also plays Nora, the 75-year-old Nora looking back as a kind of narrator. And I'm not sure I've ever seen her act before. I've seen her dance before. I've seen her choreography before. And I think I might have seen her direct, but it was good to see her acting. I wasn't so sure about the music, because I think what they're trying to do with the music is they're trying to signpost periods. So you get standards, sort of 40s, 50s, 30s, or whatever standards. You get contemporary music, and then you get some original music. And to me, that became a bit of an inconsistent cocktail of things that didn't work quite so well for me. So the reality was that I felt it was a bit of a misfire, but all around me, although I suspect either Emma Rice virgin or perhaps have seen less than me, all around me were having a finer time than I was. So I certainly wouldn't put anybody off from it, but I didn't feel this was her best work.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the Azetta named London Theatre Podcast page on Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com. The podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you, goodbye.